Hello, this is Terrence McNally. This week I'm going to share with you a couple of my favorite previously recorded interviews. In the first half of the hour, I'll speak with George McGovern, longtime senator and 1972 Democratic presidential candidate, who was described by Robert Kennedy as the most decent man he'd ever met in politics. This interview originally aired in November 2005. In the second half, my guest will be Andrew Bacevich, retired U.S. Army colonel and the author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism.
I was 23, a couple of years out of college in 1972, when I packed all my belongings in a used van and traveled to Mexico. I was going to go to San Miguel de Allende and become an artist. I was, for the first time, letting myself do that. I created the most idyllic life, surrounded by beauty and nature, living with a few other would-be artists and yoga folk, and buying fresh fruit every day in the Mercado. But each week, I got the International Time magazine, and each day, I read the International Trib, and I saw a little-known senator from South Dakota, at first exceeding expectations and then actually winning Democratic primaries. I read whatever I could get my hands on, decades before the Internet, of course. In addition to his pledge to begin withdrawing U.S. troops from Vietnam on Inauguration Day, he was for universal health care, a guaranteed minimum income, tax reform. Not only that, his was a grassroots campaign, not controlled by the party bosses or the professionals, one in which someone like myself could actually make a difference. I couldn't resist. I left paradise, drove back to the States in time to work the last two primaries in California and New York, and the convention in Miami. And as a reward for my efforts, I was given the job of running the most conservative Democratic Assembly District in California. At that point, the 52nd Southeast LA County, consisting of a few Latinos, a lot of Humphrey-loving unionists, who would never forgive McGovern, and to the right of them, Wallace folks. Acknowledging that reality, I was asked to win 37% of the vote. And without a college or a junior college, without a single affluent neighborhood, with a canvassing army of mostly high school students, that's what we did. We got 37%. Unfortunately, that's all the campaign got nationally, losing to Richard Nixon 49 states to one. And in our campaign office in Downey, California, we wept. Well, today, as America is engaged in another unwinnable war, initiated again through government deception, that presidential candidate, George McGovern, is my guest. Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. Let me tell you one other thing before I bring in George McGovern. There is a movie opening this weekend in Los Angeles, a documentary on his grassroots anti-war campaign called One Bright Shining Moment. It opens at the Music Hall 3 in Beverly Hills, Doheny and Wilshire, and interviewees in that movie include McGovern, Gore Vidal, Gloria Steinem, Warren Beatty, Dick Gregory, Gary Hart. And not only that, but George McGovern and the writer, director, producer, Stephen Vittoria, will be present at the theater Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday during the day for Q&As around the film. George McGovern was a decorated World War II bomber pilot. His wartime exploits were at the center of Stephen Ambrose's The Wild Blue. He was a professor at Dakota Wesleyan. He ran the Food for Peace program under John Kennedy, represented South Dakota for two terms in the House, three terms in the Senate. And his opposition, as I said, to the Vietnam War fueled a grassroots campaign that won the 1972 Democratic presidential nomination, only to lose to Richard Nixon. Many members of Nixon's committee to reelect the president later served jail time for Watergate-connected crimes. He's written 9 books, the last two of which were The Essential America, Our Founders in the Liberal Tradition, and his most recent, Ending Hunger Now, A Challenge to Persons of Faith. Welcome, George McGovern, to Free Forum.
It's good to be on with you today.
Okay, so you heard my story of how I was just one of the thousands and thousands of McGovern's army?
I was so moved by your introduction and what you did in 72 that I've told my hosts here they have to let me stay here until 25 minutes after the hour, so that'll give us a little more time to talk.
I thank you, and I really do thank you, because I know when 10 minutes ago I was told that I would only have you till quarter after, so thank you very much. I want listeners to get to know the people behind the work, the ideas, and the movements, and so on. How did you end up running for president, George McGovern?
It was the war in Vietnam. You know, I was a junior senator from a little state with only 3 electoral votes. I don't think that I would have been compelled to get in that race for the presidency were it not for my anguish over what seemed to me to be an outrageously mistaken war in Vietnam. So that was the driving force that brought me into that race.
And this all is spelled out in the film One Bright Shining Moment, but you'd voted for the Gulf of Tonkin, which you say is the decision you most regret in your life. You, however, were an opponent from the very start. And was it just that as you looked around after the 68, in which Nixon had beaten Humphrey, and you looked around prior to 72 and said, someone's got to do it?
That's right. I felt that the case had not been made among the Democratic presidential hopefuls, and that somebody had to make that case. We couldn't simply say, well, we're for the war, we can run it better than the Republicans. That didn't wash with me, and I don't think it would have with the American people. Obviously, the Vietnam issue was not the only one, but it was the transcendent issue, and it was tearing this country apart. I honestly believe that until we terminated our mistaken involvement in that war in Southeast Asia, that we weren't going to really be able to address the other problems before the country.
Very clear, very clear. Let me, what I want to do for most of the time I have you today, George, is talk about the lessons of 72 and that period for the present. But before I do, let me ask you this question. Your campaign and the reforms the McGovern Commission instituted in the nomination and convention process are at least partially blamed, have been ever since, for the failures of the Democratic Party ever since. What's your perspective on that, and is there truth to that, or what's the real meaning?
It's a total fiction. You know, those reforms were mandated by the delegates to the 1968 convention. They knew that the party was in a mess. They knew that what was coming across on television was the picture of a party split across the middle over the war and other issues, and that something had to be done to change the way we were picking presidential nominating delegates. For example, in a number of states, not more than 10% of the delegates who were going to nominate our presidential candidate were women. Even though women in every state were slightly more than 50% of the voting public, there were almost no people under 30 on those delegations that went to the 68 convention. Very few blacks, very few Hispanics. All across the board, what you had was a convention largely of middle-aged, middle-class men. Now, I'm not against people like that. I was one myself at that time. But I don't think they ought to dominate the presidential nominating process to the exclusion of women and young people and the minorities. That's not the way American democracy is supposed to work. These people who say those reforms ruined the Democratic Party don't know what they're talking about.
I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with George McGovern, three-term senator from South Dakota and 1972 Democratic presidential candidate, someone who Robert Kennedy, the late Robert Kennedy, described as the most decent man he'd ever met in politics. And from my knowledge of George McGovern over 30-some years, I agree. One Bright Shining Moment, a documentary on his grassroots anti-war campaign, opens this week in L.A. at the Music Hall 3, Wilshire and Doheny in Beverly Hills, opens Friday. And George McGovern and the director, producer, writer of the film, Stephen Vittoria, will be at the theater this weekend for Q&As Friday and Saturday nights and at the daytime shows on Sunday. Quite a treat, a chance to meet a true American hero. What do you think of the current anti-war movement, both outside and inside the political parties? And let me add, have you seen today's news that both the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate have proposals on the table right now that call for Iraqi forces to take the lead next year and for the Bush administration to lay out a strategy for ending the war?
Well, I think that's all to the good, and I'm glad it's happening. It's long overdue. This war is going nowhere. We never should have gotten in there. I don't think you should send young Americans out to die in a foreign country unless America's national security is on the line, unless it's essential to the safety and defense of America. Iraq was no threat to us. They had a miserable dictator in charge of the country, but he had done nothing against us and was no threat to us. And we can't send the American army into every country where they have political problems and hope that we can set things aright. We don't have the power or the responsibility to do that. So I'm glad that even since this last election a year ago, I have seen clearly, as I'm sure our listeners have, I've seen a weakening of support for the war. People are beginning to think it was a mistake. And both the parties are now looking for opportunities, I think, to make a graceful exit out of that mistaken war.
Now, are you afraid, as some would be, I think, that recall in 68, Nixon was elected with a secret plan to end the war? And would you be afraid that that some of these moves would be merely to shore up support for the Republicans in 2006 to take the thunder from those who opposed the war in the Democratic Party or further to the left, and yet actually just slightly reduce the quagmire rather than truly change it?
I think some people are motivated exactly by those considerations. They want a face-saving way. Not to say they were wrong in supporting our entry into this war, but a face-saving way to get out of something that they see no end to. I don't think the American people are going to buy that. They saw that Nixon's secret plan to end the war lasted for 4 years, during which 40% of all the Americans who died in the Vietnam War were killed, almost half of all of our casualties in that war took place after Nixon said he had a secret plan to end the war, and then took another 4 years of fighting and killing and bombing before finally the Congress forced him to terminate our involvement there.
Yes, as you point out in the film, on the day he was elected, he could have done as you pledged to do and begin the withdrawal. Then nothing was gained by the four more years.
And I don't go for these secret plans. That may be the earmarks of a police state. It's not the earmarks of a democracy. I think the American people ought to be told the facts, and the president ought to lay out a plan, a disengagement. I hope that people are not going to buy another one of these so-called secret plans.
Let me read, by the way, I found various quotes from your past, and the acceptance speech you made in 1972 at the Democratic Convention, which I was one of the young folk on the floor there to witness, included these. I'm going to read a few paragraphs, actually, and then I'd like your comments in the view from, as I say, 33 years later. This is the time for truth, not falsehood. In a democratic nation, no one likes to say that his inspiration came from secret arrangements by closed doors. But in the sense, that is how my candidacy began. I'm here as your candidate tonight in large part because during four administrations of both parties, a terrible war has been chartered behind closed doors. I want those doors opened, and I want that war closed. And I make these pledges above all others. The doors of government will be opened, and that war will be closed. This is the time. It is a time for this land to become again a witness to the world for what is just and noble in human affairs. It is a time to live more with faith and less with fear, with an abiding confidence that can sweep away the strongest barriers between us and teach us that we are truly brothers and sisters. From secrecy and deception in high places, come home, America. From military spending so wasteful that it weakens our nation, come home, America. From the entrenchment of special privileges in tax favoritism, from the waste of idle lands to the joy of useful labor, from the prejudice based on race and sex, from the loneliness of the aging poor and the despair of the neglected sick, come home, America. Those were your words in 72. Could you reflect on them now in 2005?
It makes me sad to hear those words spoken so eloquently by you, because when I spoke them, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and 95% of the television audience was in bed, sound asleep. My mother saw and heard me, my wife, the delegates on the convention floor, but that was one of the tragic errors in that 1972 convention. We let primetime television, primetime radio, get away from us. That speech should have been delivered about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, somewhere thereabouts, when we had 80 or 90 million people watching that.
Isn't it chilling, though, also to see deception, secrecy, tax privilege? I mean, all these issues 33 years later.
Yeah, it's sad because I've been looking through a book of my major speeches of 72. It's called An American Journey. It's published by Random House right after the 72 campaign. And I was looking up a couple of references there, and I started reading those speeches. And they're as relevant today as when they were delivered in July of 1972. We've got very much the same problems. No adequate health care, no just tax system, no straight-out, straightforward discussion of the central problems of the country, an unwise war. You'd think that nothing had happened.
Yeah, like someone could have gone to sleep that night while they were waiting for your speech, woken up today, and nothing would have changed.
That's right. I think Rip Van Winkle would have had a field day with that situation.
Now, let me ask you to look again from your unique vantage point, having led the most grassroots, principled presidential campaign of my lifetime. Watching your campaign in the movie, it struck me not as a fluke at that point, but as the natural outgrowth of the civil rights movements and the student and the anti-war activism. It made sense that the grassroots would now enter into electoral politics in a big way. Now, what the problem is, though, it looks from the present as if we tried it once. For the first time, inventing it as we went along, we lost to a ruthless, experienced, and wealthy team, many of whom, as I pointed up, ended up doing jail time. And yet, rather than getting a chance to get better at it, we've never had a campaign like it since. It's held up as a failure to be avoided at all costs. If you were talking to a 24-year-old today, what would you tell him or her or millions like them about how to bring that kind of authentic grassroots power to life again and how not to let it die this time?
First of all, tell the truth. That was the key ingredient of the 72 campaign. People were convinced that I was speaking the truth. They didn't argue that I was always right on everything, but they knew that I was proclaiming what I thought was right. I was giving it my best effort to get at the bottom of the central problems before the country and then speak straight out what I thought ought to be the solutions. It's true we lost that campaign, but it triggered in American politics the birth of all kinds of political movements since then that are still with us. That campaign of 72 wasn't a complete failure. We did force an end to the war in Vietnam. 6 months after the election, Nixon was on the way out of office. Agnew had already resigned. Many people, as you pointed out, were brought to justice and sent off to prison. None of those things happened to anybody in my campaign in 72. It was an honorable, straightforward campaign. We lost, but that doesn't mean that we sacrificed things that were fundamental. We stayed with the truth. We stayed with integrity. I'm going to have to, at this point, face the reality of speech and leave you.
Okay.
I want to tell you how much it means to me to be on this program today, and I hope all your listeners will come see that film that Steve Vittoria has produced. I'm going to be there to greet them.
Okay. Thank you very much, George. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your time over the years since World War II, really. You've been an America hero ever since then, and I look forward to, I'll drop by the theater and meet you this weekend.
Look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'm Terry McNally, and I have just been speaking with George McGovern, three-term senator from South Dakota, 1972 Democratic presidential candidate, talking about the lessons of that campaign looked at through the perspective from 30-some years later. And there is a film just coming out this weekend called One Bright Shining Moment. It's a documentary of George McGovern and that grassroots campaign. It includes a lot of folks speaking both back then and now about that campaign. And it opens this weekend at the Music Hall 3 in Beverly Hills. That's Wilshire and Doheny. And George McGovern, as he said when he signed off, is going to be there with the writer, director, producer, Stephen Vittoria. And they will be there to do Q&A. And I know they're going to be there Friday night, Saturday night, and at some of the daytime shows on Sunday. If you want to call the theater to find out more, call 274-6869. 274-6869. That's area code 310. That's for the Music Hall Theater. And you can learn more about the film, and you can view a trailer of it at firstrunfeatures.com. And also you can get information at Lemley.com, you know, the Lemley movie theaters, which include it. Okay, now, I was going to say some of the folks that are in the film. McGovern himself, Gore Vidal, Gloria Steinem, Warren Beatty, Dick Gregory, Gary Hart, Howard Zinn, Ron Kovic. It's narrated by Amy Goodman and produced, written, and directed by Stephen Vittoria. I may bring Stephen in for a moment, but first, I feel the need to say a few words about another frequent guest on this program. The L.A. Times has fired longtime progressive columnist and Iraq war critic Robert Scheer. And if you disagree, as I do, with this action and will miss his passionate and articulate weekly column, let the Times know how you feel. You would do that at www.latimes.com. And it's a much longer email address than that to actually leave the information, but I'll give it one time, and then if you need it, you can email me, temcnally@att.net. It's www.latimes.com/services/site/la-comment-op-ed. And that should get you to a place where you can leave a letter letting the L.A. Times know how you feel. There's a demonstration going on even as we speak outside the L.A. Times building at the First Street entrance, First and Spring down in L.A. If you're off lunch at work downtown, you might want to join them. Protesters are going to be distributing slices of Wonder Bread to signify the blanding of this newspaper. Scheer had worked at the Times for 30 years. The last 12 as a weekly columnist in the op-ed page, he had a substantial following. His columns were often the most emailed of the story, so it wasn't a question of that he didn't bring in readers. An announcement of the protest read this way: Robert Scheer's anti-war voice is critical. L.A. Times readers will not tolerate the paper's op-ed page tilting further to the right with the firing of Scheer and with no one holding Scheer's spot as a passionate and contrarian national progressive voice. Scheer himself, in response to his firing, he included the following words. The publisher, Jeff Johnson, who's offered not a word of explanation to me, and there was an article in today's L.A. Times about the changes in the op-ed page, and it again gave no justification. He said, Jeff Johnson has privately told people that he hated every word that I wrote. I assume that mostly refers to my exposing the lies used by President Bush to justify the invasion of Iraq. Fortunately, 60% of Americans now get the point. But only after tens of thousands of Americans and Iraqis have been killed and maimed as the carnage spirals out of control. My only regret is that my pen was not sharper and my words tougher. Let me bring in Stephen Vittoria here for, we'll have just a couple of minutes. Stephen?
Terry, how are you?
I'm very good. Stephen Vittoria, writer, director, producer of One Bright Shining One, which opens this week at the Music Hall 3. You heard the interview with George?
You know, I sure did, and I've been making the film for a long time, and this was one of those few interviews that actually reminded me why I made the film. I just thought he was brilliant, and he's as relevant now as he was 30 years ago, and unfortunately, his message is as relevant now as it was 30 years ago. We haven't learned a whole hell of a lot, and I think George's message is testament to that.
Yeah, and just to clarify for folks who want the real specifics, what features will they be able to Q&A you and George McGovern at?
The 5:40 showing on Friday evening, the 8:30 showing on Friday evening. Same is true for both shows on Saturday. And on Sunday, I believe, definitely the first matinee, which is, I think, like a 1-2 o'clock showing, and then probably the second one as well. George McGovern is 83 years old, and I've been all over the country with him with this film, from New York to Los Angeles, and he definitely outdistances me, and he can keep it going, but I sometimes have to watch his schedule to make sure we don't tire him out. But he is amazing, and when he gets into a group of people, he's as exhilarating now as he was in 72. A lot of people said he doesn't have charisma, but his ideas have a great deal of charisma. It's probably the only thing we should be listening to.
And as he pointed out, Stephen, when I asked what he would say to people today, he said, tell the truth. The truth is what made that campaign work. And if you think back to 2004, the clearest difference this time between the Republican candidate and the Democratic was once the Democratic candidate, John Kerry, got painted as someone who didn't tell the truth, who wasn't authentic, who wasn't speaking his heart. I don't think he ever overcame that.
I think you're absolutely right.
Okay, I'm going to let you go.
Thank you.
And people, you have a chance to meet George McGovern and Stephen Vittoria this weekend at the Music Hall Theater, where you can see One Bright Shining Moment. Thank you, Stephen.
This is Terrence McNally. Stay tuned for the second half, when my guest will be Andrew Bacevich, retired U.S. Army colonel, professor at Boston University, and the author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. This interview originally aired in September 2008.
As we look forward to the end of what I believe to be the tragic and failed George Bush presidency, I'm going to devote some interviews to exploring new directions and new policies. And last week, I looked at security strategy and planning with Thomas Barnett, author of The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century. And today, I continue looking at that set of issues with Andrew Bacevich, author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. I'd heard of Dr. Bacevich and read some op-eds, but as soon as I saw his interview a few weeks back with Bill Moyers, I knew I had to talk with him. I was surprised and pleased the next day when I looked at Barnes & Noble for his book and that it had jumped to number one in sales. I believe Andrew Bacevich in his new book pulls things together in ways that I hadn't seen before. Things like our politics of personality, the rise of the imperial presidency, and our national culture of consumption. I say each week that I'm looking for pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work, and I believe today's guest is pulling some of them together in ways that make our problems clearer and perhaps change more possible. To set things up a bit, let me list, as I did last week, some of what I believe to be the key issues and questions in the area of security and military conflict. Is the United States actually the sole superpower? And if so, what does that mean? If the United States is pursuing empire, what are the costs of our imperial adventures? How should national security really be properly defined and pursued? What actual threats do we face? How should they be prioritized? How do we challenge what I have called a strategy-free consensus of McCain, Obama, and really most of mainstream political figures and experts that we need to sustain or increase present levels of military spending? What realities are we obscuring by the flawed notion of a global war on terror? How can we best isolate the worst terrorists as pariahs within their own societies? On what principle should our relationship with the rest of the world be based? What are our actual security resources and assets, and how can they most wisely be employed? What are the wisest and most necessary security investments we can make? And finally, what would an honest, realistic, and wise discussion of security choices and priorities look like? On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that, as I said, I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Andrew Bacevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, served 23 years in the U.S. Army, retiring with the rank of colonel. He also lost his son in Iraq last year. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he received his Ph.D. in American diplomatic history from Princeton. His writing has appeared in Foreign Affairs, The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, The New York Times, The L.A. Times, The Wall Street Journal. He's the author of several books, including The New American Militarism and his newest, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Welcome, Andrew Bacevich, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Well, thanks very much for having me. Let me say your list of questions is really a good list.
Thank you. I mean, I've thought a lot about this, and I think that sort of frames what we're going to talk about. Before we jump into it, I like listeners to get to know a bit about the people behind the ideas and the work. Briefly, what was your path from the U.S. Army to the work you do today?
Well, my service in the Army coincided with, in a sense, the late Cold War. I got out of the Army in 1992, and I certainly was then, and I imagine I would still describe myself today as a committed Cold Warrior. I thought that was a necessary cause. I thought that the Soviet Empire posed a security threat. But I also thought that if and when the Cold War ever ended, that the United States might go back to being more of a normal nation, which to me implied not isolationism, but I guess to put it in the starkest terms, a retreat from empire with greater attention being given to the well-being of our own people. What actually happened in the aftermath of the Cold War was that our appetite for empire increased, and especially worrying to me, our emphasis, our willingness to use military power also increased dramatically. And this was not simply something that conservatives or neoconservatives promoted, but it was something that, that liberal Democrats in the Clinton era promoted. So it was the failure to make what seemed to me to be wise adjustments to the end of the Cold War that set me to rethinking U.S. foreign policy.
Okay, that makes very good sense to me. Let me, before we go into a lot of more detail, let me just, we've just come out of two political conventions, and in an article in the American Conservative in March of this year, you claim that Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama is the best choice for conservatives in the fall. You also said both of them endorse the notion that a global war on terror provides the right frame for thinking about U.S. national security policy going forward. Do you still hold that Barack Obama is the choice of conservatives, and could you explain that a little more?
Well, the case I made for conservatives to support Obama was a very narrowly framed case. I mean, I don't believe that Barack Obama is a conservative. He's a liberal, and I don't use that as some kind of a poisonous accusation. People on the left have principles to which they adhere that happen to be different from the principles that people on the right believe in. But my case for supporting Obama really was that he has said that he would end U.S. involvement in Iraq, and my belief is that if Americans elect Obama on that basis, and if he follows through on that commitment, in effect, we will be rendering a judgment of the Iraq war as having been a mistake, a misguided commitment. And if that happens, my hope is that there might be an opportunity for a fundamental debate about U.S. foreign policy.
Right.
And I would hope that in that debate, if it were to occur, that conservative or realist views might have a chance of being heard.
Now, right.
Having said that, mm-hmm. I'm not actually convinced at this point that Obama is any more interested in that fundamental debate about foreign policy than Senator McCain is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then let's delve down deeper into what comes up in your book. One of the things you also say is, of course, that the fundamental problem, I'm quoting now, facing the country will remain stubbornly in place no matter who's elected in November. What will not go away is a yawning disparity between what Americans expect and what they're willing or able to pay. How does that play in all of the rest of our lives beyond the military, and then how does it influence our attitudes towards security in the military?
Yeah, I mean, I think to putting it in very simple terms, we are no longer willing to live within our means. I mean, that is certainly the case in many, many, many families, individual families. I mean, our propensity to save, to put things up for a rainy day is essentially non-existent. This is all related to this penchant for endless penchant, insatiable penchant for consumption. But that also exists at the national level. We supposedly live in a time in which there's been a conservative ascendancy in politics. Conservatives once believed in doing things like balancing the budget, you know, pay as you go. We've got an ostensibly conservative president, and this year the budget deficit's going to be close to $500 billion. The total national debt is now closing in on $10 trillion. If you look at the entitlements that to which we are committed, they're utterly unaffordable. So the big problem, it seems to me, is this refusal to live within our means. Exacerbating the problem is the inclination, especially apparent in the last 20 years, of policymakers to rely on military power to try to prolong or to push back the day of reckoning. But the truth is, as we've learned in Iraq and we're learning in Afghanistan, our military power is nowhere as great as people imagined. I mean, your first question was, are we the sole superpower? It seems to me that the whole concept of a superpower has come to be pernicious because it gets in the way of us actually seeing ourselves as we are and seeing our circumstances the way they are.
Okay, I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich. He's the author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. So we spend as if we have more money than we have, and you're saying we use our force as if we have more power than we have.
Absolutely.
Okay. One of the other things I found very interesting was your take on the presidency and the imperial presidency, but a lot of people have talked about that for the last year, but you actually link it to the creation of the president as the super celebrity. You say, I'm going to read here, beginning with the election of John F. Kennedy in 1960, the occupant of the White House has become a combination of demigod, father figure, inevitably the betrayer of inflated hopes, pope, pop star, scold, scapegoat, crisis manager, commander-in-chief, agenda settler, moral philosopher, interpreter of the nation's charisma, object of veneration, the butt of jokes, all rolled into one. How does that exacerbate the problems we're talking about?
I think it gets in the way of us having serious politics. I mean, I find almost nauseating the emphasis given to these two individuals now running for the presidency, Obama and McCain, which seems to imply an expectation that whatever the outcome of the election, if your guy wins, then your guy is somehow going to save the country, is going to wave a magic wand, is going to make all the problems go away. Both candidates, I believe, have promised to achieve energy and independence in
right.
something like 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to happen. Now, trying to achieve something like energy independence is, I believe, a tremendously important strategically imperative. But it's something that would require an effort on the part of the nation, which certainly includes, at the level of the federal government, the Congress, but also would include state and local governments, and above all, would include a commitment on the part of the American people. And none of that exists. So to me, the hoopla that surrounds the presidential election in some respects ends up being an excuse for us to avoid understanding that the collective responsibility for our problems really lies much closer to us, the people, than it does to, you know, whoever happens to live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah. Now, I'm sort of guessing that, as I said, I haven't heard these sort of notions woven together quite this way before. But this whole idea of the presidency the president is a superstar, and these presidential elections, interminable presidential election this time, as a reality show, an entertainment show or something, I think that grows out of, you know, other forces in our society, but it actually has made it much easier for George Bush and Dick Cheney and company to push this imperial presidency, don't you believe?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, I think that, I mean, the shrewd people on the inside have understood that our dysfunctional political system and these expectations that somehow the president's supposed to sort things out really has provided an opportunity for accruing a tremendous amount of power at the center, and then using that power in ways that are using it in secret, using it in ways that reality gets concealed from the rest of us. My point is simply to say that shame on us that we have permitted this to happen. Shame on us that, in a sense, we tolerate it.
Yeah, shame on us. I would second you at every level, from the citizens who view it as entertainment to the congressmen who abdicate, time and again, their role in this. And you hearken back to a time when the president was a significant figure. Obviously, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was a huge figure in this country, but that there was a give and take in the legislative branches and between all the areas of government that actually real politics and real taking on of public problems took place.
Well, you know, I don't want to romanticize our political past. That would be a big mistake. But it does seem to me that there was a time in the 20th century and in the 19th century when there were figures in the Senate and figures in the House of Representatives who had as much or perhaps even more national standing than the president itself, so that there were other voices that were heard, and they were people who didn't view themselves as simply members of a party in which they're supposed to go along with the herd. I mean, Senator McCain advertises himself as a maverick. Real mavericks were people like Robert La Follette back in the World War I and 1920s era. So we've lost all that, I think.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich, author of Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. I highly recommend this book. It's brief, it's clear, and it's provocative. Sticking with the presidents, even though we've said they shouldn't be as important as they are, you make a very interesting point about President Carter. And I'm gonna first say what you've been saying about how were we to achieve or seriously aim for energy independence, that would call for sacrifice on the part of the people. It would call for us reorganizing the way we do things. People have said the same thing. We've tried to fight two wars without any involvement of the people. The sacrifices are all by the troops and the troops
Absolutely.
Alone. And you can speak more to that, but I'm going to read something you wrote about President Carter. I think we've misunderstood and underestimated President Carter. He was the one president of our time who recognized, I think, the challenges awaiting us if we refuse to get our house in order. You describe Reagan as the modern prophet of profligacy, the politician who gave moral sanction to the empire of consumption. Obviously, those two, by the public, by the pundits, by conventional wisdom, are held in opposite regard.
Right. I mean, I emphasize in the book what I think is the great historical significance of the speech that President Carter gave in July of 1979. This was the so-called Malaise speech. He was castigated, laughed at the time for what he said.
And kind of doomed his presidency, yeah.
Speech in contemporary politics.
And how so?
How so? Because, as you suggested, we have to remember this was at the time of the second energy shock, when sort of the awareness of our growing energy independence was still beginning to sink among Americans. And Carter said in this very important speech, "Look, energy independence is suggestive of a country that is going down the wrong path toward dependency, and is going down that path toward dependency because we are embracing a false understanding of the meaning of freedom." And his concern was a concern about materialism and consumption and self-indulgence. And he summoned Americans to say, look, we need to rethink. We are devoted to freedom. We need to ask ourselves what we really value about freedom. And we need to embrace those true values. And the way to begin to embrace an authentic version of freedom is by attacking head-on this problem of energy independence. We need to change the way we live to be independent in terms of energy but also change the way we live in order to embrace an authentic definition of freedom.
Right. In other
and of
words,
of course, Ronald Reagan said, you don't need to do any of that. You don't need to tighten your belts. We can have everything we want. The, you know, it's morning in America.
Yeah.
And Reagan told us what we wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And we embraced Reagan, the great majority of us, and we rejected Jimmy Carter. And I think that that was a fateful, the election of 1980 is a fateful moment in American history. And in my judgment, we took the wrong path.
Yeah. In other words, what Carter was saying, and you know, in rereading his words in your book, it really brought it home to me. I mean, he was actually asking questions on a level of culture and perhaps even on a spiritual dimension.
Yep.
About what is the nature of this country that was founded on ideals and ideas, mm-hmm. not on power.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to make the argument that makes Carter
yeah.
a great president. In many respects, he was a failed president. But I am arguing that of all of our presidents over the past 50 years, he was the one who had the clearest understanding of the dilemmas that we face. And he invited us as people to contemplate them, and we said no.
Yeah, and what's interesting, as you point out, he was not maybe that good as a president, wasn't that good in many ways, but the fact that others didn't pick up his question, his charge, but kind of once Reagan won his overwhelming victory, I think we've seen ever since then people basically wanting to promise what you want.
Oh, I think you're exactly right. I mean, they are in a sense, they are all successors of Reagan. And the important questions that Carter posed still have not been answered.
Yeah, well, yeah,
despite,
and they aren't even
the fact that our dependency on foreign oil and the indebtedness that we are accruing is orders of magnitude greater than they were back in 1979.
That's right. At that point, you know, that was only 9 years after we had stopped being the largest producer of oil in the world.
Right.
We were in a very different position in terms of...
Right.
There's points at which you point out...
Change then would have been much easier than change is going to be now.
Right, and change that started then would put us in a position one can hardly imagine. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich, author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. We've got about five and a half minutes, Dr. Bacevich. Let's talk right now about the current problems. Iraq, Afghanistan, you say here, were we to actually gauge the actual existing threat, and there is a threat. I mean, 9/11 happened. There are people out there who want to kill us. But were we to actually gauge that threat in a realistic way, we would see that open-ended global war is not only unnecessary, but it's probably counterproductive. And there are better ways to go about keeping us secure than to engage in global war.
Yeah, it seems to me that we should understand that 9/11 happened less because Osama bin Laden and his band of cutthroats were so smart and so savvy and so cunning than that we just let our guard down. We weren't paying attention. We left the door unlocked and they came in. Violent Islamic radicalism is, as you said, a real threat. But to compare it to the threat posed by Nazi Germany, as the Bush administration has done, is absolutely nonsense. We need to see the threat, in my judgment, as, in essence, an international criminal conspiracy. Now, this is an international criminal conspiracy that's not looking for money. It's one that's motivated by a religious fervor. But they are criminals. And the proper response to criminality is police action. The basis of our strategy should be that the United States should lead an international, comprehensive, ruthless, protracted effort to identify and root out the Al-Qaeda network and to destroy it. And that does not, should not entail occupying and or invading and occupying countries. So my problem with framing the strategy as a global war on terror is that it seems to emphasize military action, large-scale military action, when it's a much smaller scale, more precise action that actually is in order.
Right. And on the other hand, or in the other piece of that, it would seem to me, is. So that's tracking down the criminals. As I believe I said at the top, it seems to me that the other piece of that is to take those actions that would isolate those sorts of terror, those sorts of criminals, those sorts of terrorists as pariahs within their own societies.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, I in addition to the international police effort, it seems to me that we should try to reconceptualize the idea of containment and try to consider how containment would provide the basis of a strategy relative to the Islamic world. And I don't mean containment to be operationalized the way it was operationalized during the Cold War. We don't need a new NATO. But we need to take actions to prevent the problems of the Islamic world, like violent radicalism, from getting at us. And I honestly believe that over time that Muslims themselves will come to recognize that the program offered by people like Osama bin Laden is an empty one. It doesn't lead anywhere. I believe Muslims themselves will come to understand that they have to, that Islam's going to have to reconcile itself to modernity. Doesn't mean that they're going to be like us. They shouldn't want to be like us. But it means, I think, that they will eventually, over time, come to accept the principal manifestations of modernity and will be able to live in some semblance of harmony with them. That's a long-term project, but they need to figure out how to live with modernity. It's not up to us to try to impose modernity on them, which, of course, is what the Bush administration has been trying to do in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. It seems to me it's a much more difficult, much more nuanced analysis. It goes back to the same sorts of kinds of deep analysis Carter was proposing with regard to freedom,
right,
in terms of, oh, okay, we had thought modernity would just inevitably sweep the planet. It turns out there's a bump in the road here.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Wright says that, you know, we're asking them to accept democracy before they've had the Enlightenment or Reformation. Now, that doesn't apply to the entire cultures, but it applies to certain segments of the cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me what the deep analysis is how do we make it most likely, how do we, in everything we do, make it most likely that that movement takes place?
Right. And mucking around in their business has exactly the opposite effect.
Yes, exactly. If someone says only kill the infidel and you go around reinforcing the image that you are the infidel,
right,
you leave little hope. What if I gave you 30 seconds, what should listeners do?
Well, you know, I've been asked a lot. I've been asked that quite frequently since this book came out, and I don't have a good answer. I'm pretty cynical about politics, and I don't see a lot of willingness to, on the part of most Americans, to, you know, look at ourselves in the mirror. It seems to me the most that we can do as individuals is to model what it is to be a good citizen. I mean, to show in the way we live our own lives, our personal lives, our professional lives, that this is the way the country ought to work. This is what American society should manifest. This is a true and authentic version of freedom. You know, if you do that, I don't know that that's going to, you know, transform the entire country, but at least one could have the satisfaction of knowing that you did your best in your own sphere, and that's about all I could say.
So one thing would be, rather than assuming the problems are to be solved by the president or that the problems are out there, it's to say, am I living the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in a way that really matters?
You said it better than I did, but
okay,
That's exactly what I meant.
So again, the book is The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Thank you to G, my engineer, to Stan Mizrahi in production, to Matt Perez in traffic. To you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week. Email me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally, at mac.com, T.E. McNally@mac.com. If you want to learn more about my podcast, my website, or you want to get a weekly list that I send out telling you who's going to be on and a bit about what we're going to talk about. Thank you, Andrew Bacevich, and keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me on.
The This is Tara Devlin, a.k.a. Taradactyl from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. And this is my two-minute tirade, sponsored by Credo Mobile. Just as female Republicans are required to be even bigger misogynists than Republican males, non-white Republicans are embraced by not challenging the white power structure. They're the human shields for the GOP's institutionalized racist policies that divide and conquer us all. Like Tim Scott, for example, the first black Republican senator from the South since Reconstruction. While in his role of honorary co-chairman of the congressional trip to Selma to mark the 50th anniversary of the March for Voting Rights that ended in protesters being beaten by police, Scott assured Republicans not to view his support for the Selma commemoration as support for restoring the Voting Rights Act. He said the two matters should be decoupled. Like the way Martin Luther King's legacy is decoupled from his fight for labor, economic rights, and social justice, as if riding over crumbling infrastructure to a low-wage, no-benefit, no-retirement job, one misfortune away from bankruptcy and homelessness is what everyone fought for. Because now we ride to the bottom in an integrated bus. The racial abuse the DOJ found in the Ferguson and St. Louis police forces shows us Bloody Sunday is still festering. But dividing Americans along racial lines is a trick as old as oligarchy. In a truly democratic system, even the cops know that if anyone is oppressed, everyone is oppressed. We all have to finally recognize that racial justice is economic justice, or be permanently decoupled from the American dream. Go to CredoAction.com and sign the petition to tell President Obama to sign an executive order strengthening police accountability nationwide. That's CredoAction.com. Go there now. We stick together. We win. This is Tara Dactyl from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. Keep listening for two-minute tirades and more on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. Check out my show at DavidPakman.com. That's David, PAKMAN.com.
I have a really funny story for you. I got an email from a viewer the other day, and the viewer said, David, due to an unfortunate situation, someone peeled my cherished David Pakman Show bumper sticker off of my truck. I was wondering where I could get another one if I can. Obviously, I'll pay. It's a matter of pride for me now. And the email sounded so unusual that because of an unfortunate situation, something happened to the sticker that I said, I will gladly send you a replacement for free if you just tell me the story. And the story is amazing. And here it is. Well, my pops is a socially conservative kind of dude. One day I was sitting on the couch and I saw him go outside with a scraper. I didn't think anything of it at the time, but the next day at work, I realized that someone had removed the David Pakman Show bumper sticker from my truck. When I got home, I asked both of my parents if they knew what happened. My mother said she had noticed the bumper sticker, but she didn't care. My father, on the other hand, had seen it and decided unilaterally, without any family discussion or forum, to remove the sticker, on the basis that this family doesn't advertise political affiliations. Now, my father is a competent man, and he believes in Obama and understands that progressivism is the future. However, when I got an Obama 2012 sign, he refused to let me stick it in our yard. I think it's because, above all else, he just doesn't want to draw attention from the neighbors. I, on the other hand, while not belligerent about my views, am willing and ready to support the causes I believe in. In this case, that meant something as little as putting a bumper sticker on my truck. I'm just trying to show my father that if someone is willing to get uppity over a bumper sticker, it is our duty as reasonable people to stay the course, hold the wheel, and steer on to freedom. David Pakman Show bumper stickers, because freedom and because liberty. And of course, I sent out another sticker for free to this individual who I am not naming, in case there is blowback as a result of this incredible scandal. But a very funny story goes out there, sees, I can just picture it sitting there, and seeing the dad with a scraper walk out into the driveway and then just walk back in. And then the next day realizing that the bumper sticker is gone. So the bumper sticker has been replaced. And if it disappears again, please let us know. And I actually would love to know if there was a discussion about the fact that a new bumper sticker arrived. I would love to know what happened there. I it seems like a conversation it would be great to be a fly on the wall for.
You've been listening to part of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and much more, check out our website, DavidPakman.com. That's David, P-A-K, MAN.com, and check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/The David Pakman Show.